You have reached a phone call from Paul, a Literary Hub podcast. To hear more, visit lithub.com. Paul Holden Graber's conversation with Cory Doctorow.
Hello?
Hello? Is this Cory Doctorow?
Yes, hi, how are
Hello.
You?
Hello, thank you for taking this phone call from me. I'm very pleased to be speaking to you. Where am I finding you?
Oh, I'm in my place in Burbank, my new home and my new home office.
So you've moved?
That's right, yeah, I live in Los Angeles now.
When did this happen? I think it escaped me.
My wife came over in mid-June, and I brought our daughter over in mid-July. And we've been kind of running around ever since getting settled in. Our container only arrived a couple of weeks ago, actually. So we've been living out of a couple of suitcases and for several months.
What's in the container?
A kind of mixed bag. It's hard to figure out what to store and what to take when you don't know how long you're staying for. It's kind of an indefinite leave. We're in the process of applying for our green card. So we really just stored stuff that we didn't think we'd want to have over until and unless we owned a house. So there is a few pieces of furniture and all of my contributors' copies of my books, which is, you know, boxes and boxes of dead trees that don't make any sense to ship across the ocean. And, you know, tax records and this and that. We kept the apartment in that we own in London. I think we're going to end up selling that too, but we left some furniture in it for the tenants who've moved in.
But you've left London for now?
For now, yeah. I mean, London is primarily a city that is hospitable to banks, not human beings. And it's basically become uninhabitable by humans. I just couldn't bear it anymore. And my wife's work brought her out here as well. Her startup, Makey Lab, was part of Disney's Techstars Accelerator. And so they gave her office space there. And she continues to have office space at Disney's Glendale campus, at the Imagineering campus where I used to work. And so she's operating out of there now for the U.S. office of her company, Makey Lab. For me, being in the U.S. makes a little more sense. I got very tired of flying back and forth across the ocean, sometimes as many as four times a month. Now, you know, we live 10 minutes from the Burbank airport, and I can do things like go to San Francisco for a morning and be back in the afternoon, which is quite nice.
When did this feeling about London start?
Well, it's been building,
it's
you know.
More than a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's been building, I think from the crash, I think it started to become much more poignant. Until then, you could kind of pretend that there was still an operating social welfare state and that people that you saw who were in trouble might have a chance of escaping. But very quickly after the crash, and particularly after the coalition government and now under the Tory government, it was really obvious that Britain was bifurcating into the kind of people who couldn't understand why all of the living space in the largest city shouldn't be turned into safe deposit boxes for offshore corrupt millionaires, and people who couldn't understand why they couldn't keep a roof over their heads anymore. And there's this sense of precarity there, this sense that at any minute you could lose everything and that there will be nothing to catch you, that just made it very hard. And even, you know, when you didn't personally feel precarious, you were surrounded by people who were losing everything, who were in deep trouble. You know, just before we left, the Tory government announced a cap to benefits that they've since climbed back on. But literally, I think 95% of the students in my daughter's state school in Hackney would have had to move, you know, out to outside of central London, probably outside of the south altogether, if the benefit cap had come in. And that would have been really devastating for those people. They were multi-generational working families living in central London, and like many poor people, they didn't have a lot of capital, cash capital, but they had a lot of personal capital. They had a lot of relationships with one another that allowed them to get by because one person could fix the other person's car or look after someone else's kids. And by atomizing those social relationships, those poor people would have been deprived of literally the only capital they had. And they would have been poor in a way that's almost impossible to overstate. They would have become internal refugees in the United Kingdom. And I think that, you know, though the Tories have climbed back on that plan, it typifies their view of the nature of humans, which is to say they're surplus to requirements. I think in the United Kingdom, the dominant view of the political classes is that the real genuine Britons are multinational corporations, and that human beings are a kind of inconvenient gut flora for them, and that where there's too many of them or where they are behaving in a way that isn't hospitable to their host organisms, they need to be purged.
Wow. Corey, do you think it's different here?
I think it is different. Because, I don't know that it's necessarily better, but it's at least different.
Because, there's one thing that I'm feeling. I mean, I know we both have you have one child, I have two children, and I'm often wondering whether what I have to offer them is so much less than what I was offered.
Yeah.
I mean that.
Well,
I
think that's right. My family enjoyed enormous benefits from social services when they turned up in Canada after the war. My grandparents were displaced people. They had nothing.
From where?
From a country that's now Belarus, but was then Poland, and from Russia. And they had nothing. And if it weren't for the social safety network, they would have been really, I think, in deep trouble. In the case of my grandmother's second husband, he arrived in Canada with virtually everyone he was related to being dead. So he had no family to fall back on anywhere in the world. And, he benefited as well. And, my family went on to be very productive members of society. My grandmother's second husband, my grandfather, he founded a business and employed lots of people and contributed economically, but they also all contributed to their communities, and they were an essential part of the Canadian fabric. I think Canada's new government is going to be better on this than the old government, although this is the party, the Liberal Party in Canada, that refused to allow any Jews into Canada during the Holocaust, where the Liberal Prime Minister at the time, when asked how many Jews Canada would allow in from Europe, he said none is too many. But I think that they've reformed their ways since then, and I think they will certainly be better than the outgoing Tories. But the kind of social welfare infrastructure we have now compared to the post-war infrastructure is so anemic. And the view of people who participate in social welfare is so vituperative. I mean, the hate reserved for the poor, especially in the United Kingdom, is so venomous that it's really kind of hard to understand, except as the kind of hatred that people have for things that they fear more than things that they despise. That there's this, I think, this view maybe that all of us, rather than being millionaires in waiting, are refugees in waiting. And when we see people who are becoming internal economic refugees or who are traditional refugees coming from places like Syria, I think we see an uncomfortable future for ourselves.
My goodness me. I nearly feel like I want to go back to what is in those boxes and what will come out, and if now arriving back in the States feels to you and near Los Angeles feels to you like a homecoming.
Not exactly a homecoming, but the direction of travel, especially when we left, the direction of travel in the United States was more optimistic than the direction of travel in the United Kingdom. Things have changed a bit with the election of Jeremy Corbyn to run the Labour Party and some shifts in the discourse there. But, in the United States, when we left, they had just passed the first anti-surveillance law in a generation, and then the subsequent week passed two more amendments. There is a genuine debate about race and poverty and policy. politics here, albeit one that's often very dysfunctional. You know, you have organizations of parents who are getting together to refuse to allow any of their children to take the standardized tests.
Are you for
that? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that, you know, standardized testing, as someone who was raised by teachers, standardized testing to me is grotesque. It treats education as a kind of business whose product is standardized productive humans, as opposed to something that does this very idiosyncratic business of learning. And I think it's, you know, standardized testing is part and parcel of the idea that teachers can't be trusted, and that teachers, as people who are on the public payroll, are doing something that is innately suspicious and has to be monitored and made accountable, as though finding out whether or not the quantifiable parts of education are performing well tells you anything about how the qualitative parts of education are performing. And so, yeah, I'm very glad that we see parents here resisting standardized testing. Thankfully, my daughter won't come up against it for a few years here. She had her first standardized test in the United Kingdom last year at the age of 7, which was shocking.
How did she do?
I don't know that we even got results. If we did, I put them out of my mind.
Yeah,
if we did, I put them out of my mind.
They may not be in the
box. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, my daughter's school was, the teachers and the administrators there were amazing. But they had their hands cuffed by, the mandates that came down from above about standardized testing and standardized education. You know, for example, they weren't allowed to grant permission for students to take leaves to do activities with their parents because their funding was based on attendance, as though attendance was a good proxy for learning. And so they were even required to turn down requests where there were, like, really obvious benefits to kids, you know, chances, for example, for my daughter to go away with her grandmother, my mother, who designed the K-3 curriculum in Ontario and the evaluation process for it. Certainly getting one-on-one tutelage while doing things in Canada was good for her, and there was no argument that it wouldn't be, but, you know, they were bound over by their administration to refuse as a first measure all requests like that. It was, you know, it was a nonsense, right? It literally, everybody agreed that it made no sense, and yet nobody could figure out how to solve it.
And it seems that what you've just described is a situation we find ourselves often in, namely, the problem is real, we see that it's a problem, but we do very little about it.
Yeah, and, you know, this is the thing, that the theme that I'm interested in terms of both technology and science fiction is the collective action problem, you know, the deadlock, you could call it the Jeremy Corbyn problem, right? The self-fulfilling prophecy that he is unelectable and therefore he can't get nominated, and therefore when he does get nominated, the party establishment, turns their back on him and actively seeks to sabotage him. It's the Bernie Sanders problem. It's the Lawrence Lessig problem. You know, this is the problem that, you and everybody else need to coordinate your action in order to solve something that all of you are suffering under, and you all agree, but you can't figure out how to coordinate. That is, I think, the wicked problem of our age. And it's one that technology has some really interesting things to say about. You know, this is the whole heart and soul of Kickstarter, that you can use, threshold collective action systems where you say, well, none of us are bound over to take any action until enough of us agree that we'll take action. And then when enough of us show up, we all take action in unison. You could really see how that might work, for example, in politics, where you could have a doorbell ringer who says, you know, hi, I'm here to represent a third party, and I'm not going to ask you to throw away your vote. Obviously, we all want to get out, you know, the rascal who's currently in power. And if voting for me meant that that person would continue in office, well, that would be a terrible trade-off. All I'm asking is that you register someone who would vote for me if enough people who are in your neighborhood agree that they would also vote for me. And then come election day, you know, your whole constituency will be made aware of what's going on. We'll send you texts every time someone fulfills their promise to go to the poll and vote for me. And then you can make an informed decision about whether or not you're throwing away your vote. And this seems like a way to kind of back form a preferential ballot into the first-past-the-post system that paralyzes politics by making you choose from the lesser of two terrible evils.
What is Lessig up to now? He's running, no, for office.
No, he's not anymore. So yeah. the Democratic establishment.
I lost the thread there a little bit with him because at some point I felt he was, and then
he was, and then the Democratic Party establishment changed the rules about participation in the debate in a way that would have made it impossible for him to be in the debate, and he gave up basically. And he's, as far as I know, he's very unhappy. He's been posting some fairly melancholy and angry things to his, you know, media accounts. And I feel bad about it. And I think that Larry wanted to do something that, whatever you think of the plausibility of it, that was really significant, right? Making the debate and the election a referendum on whether or not we want our politics to be dominated by a tiny number of super rich people. That's, you know, until we answer that question, all the other questions are never going to be answered to anyone's satisfaction. You know, we won't get an answer on climate change, and we won't get an answer on telecoms policy, and we won't get an answer on you know, the criminal justice reform until we have an answer that we can all agree on about who should be in charge of our politics, rich people or the broad polity.
And who should be in touch regarding our security and our privacy?
All of those questions, you know, privacy and security. I have a thesis about why privacy has become so difficult to assert in the 21st century. And I think that it has a lot to do with wealth disparity. I think that, you know, there are people who say, you know, I gave a talk at West Point a little while ago, which was a mind blower. And I met people there, people of goodwill who care about information security, who said, you know, I worry about my privacy, but I worry about it in respect of Facebook and Google. I don't really worry about the government. They already know everything about me. I work for them. And then, you know, when I go to other circles, I hear from people who say, well, I don't really worry about the private sector. I feel like, you know, I can make commercial decisions that impact how my data relates to the private sector, but I really worry about the state gathering data on me. And I think that they're confused about the nature of surveillance. You know, if you're worried about private surveillance, but not public surveillance, you have to understand that the reason the state is able to affect such massive surveillance, the reason that we went from the Stasi having to hire one snitch for every 60 people in the GDR to the NSA hiring one person for every 10,000 people they're watching in the world, is because the private sector is doing the surveillance for them, right? The way that the state spies on us is by using the tracking infrastructure that we are paying for in the form of Facebook and Google and all these other private sector innovations. You know, the NSA was literally using Google's tracking cookies to figure out that a phone that it was surveilling was the same person as a laptop that it was surveilling. And so if you expect that the public sector is going to someday regulate private surveillance, you have to first get to a place where the public sector doesn't depend on the private sector to affect its surveillance for it. They have a divided loyalty between evidence-based policy that says that gathering lots of information is corrosive to our politics and to our daily lives, and their commitment to spying on everybody, and the terrifying line that they're fed by the security services, who, you know, can go into politicians' offices and say, do you really want to be the politician who dismantled our spying capability when the next time some terrorist attack happens and we start pointing our finger at you and saying, you know, don't blame us for that failure in intelligence. Blame, you know, Senator Bumblefuck. He's the one who said we weren't allowed to spy anymore. And, you know, in the same way, if you don't worry about state surveillance, or you don't worry about private surveillance, but you worry about state surveillance, the same thing is true, right? That they are connected in this intimate way. And, you know, I think it raises the question, why are they spying in the first place? Like, why take advantage of all of this surveillance? And I think that the answer is that historically wealth disparity creates social instability. You know, Thomas Piketty in Capital in the 21st Century, he forever returns to France on the eve of the French Revolution. You know, whenever he's discussing what a critical level of wealth disparity is. He returns to the eve of the French Revolution. And his subtext, which I think Americans might miss because the French Revolution doesn't loom large in the American imagination, is that when wealth disparity reaches a certain point, poor people start building guillotines for rich people. And social instability is something that we historically address through a combination of guns and butter, right? We either do social redistribution as a means of legitimizing the system and diffusing the sense that the system needs to be torn down, or we use enforcement against people who want to dismantle the status quo. We hire guard labor, we do surveillance, we do all of the things that are part of enforcing against subversive elements. And there's a kind of curve where it's no longer economically efficient to hire cops, and it becomes more economically efficient to build roads, hospitals, and schools because it's just cheaper, right? You get more bang for your buck. Policing has diminishing returns. But when the private sector picks up your surveillance for you and does and affects a 2.5 order of magnitude improvement in the efficiency of surveillance, then surveillance starts to make sense, right? And wealth disparity can go a lot further before it becomes economically sensible to start redistributing, before it becomes rational in the kind of neoclassical economic sense to do redistribution. And so I think that, you know, these are connected, that our information security, our privacy, and wealth disparity are all really intimately connected and can't be readily disentangled.
You were talking about the booths of the novel and ways in which when it appeared, it might have made some people worried that they were becoming weaker. Now I know that you're in the middle of writing a novel yourself, which I think you told me the title is Walk Away. Can you tell me something about it? I'm so curious and eager to hear.
I've actually finished it. So it's coming out in it's coming out in 2017. My publisher has bought it. It's called Walk Away, and it's a novel about a future in which the people who are thought of as the inconvenient gut floor of corporations decide to strike out on their own. And so it's about people who walk away. They go to brownfield sites, and they use the technology of abundance, 3D printing and information-led collaborative technologies to build whatever they need without regard to the alleged property rights of other people. Because they can make whatever they want wherever they need to be, and because they there is a kind of surplus of brownfield sites left behind by modern capitalism, whenever someone comes along and challenges their legitimacy or their right to be where they are, they just walk away, and they call themselves walkaways. They just walk away from every one of those disputes and sort of take up this passive resistance that by its nature and by its existence proof of a different way of living becomes a graver threat to the status quo than any kind of active fight would be. They're living as though it were the first days of a better nation. And it pits them against the people for whom scarcity is a feature, for whom scarcity is a means of establishing their own status. And it's about the pitched battles they fight, in which one side is just trying to get away from the fight and the other side is determined to bring the fight to them.
How much in the future is it?
It's, you know, 50 to 100 years, I guess. I got a quote on it this morning from Neal Stephenson, or he called it something like the. Let me see if I can find it here. It was a great quote. Hang on. Let's see. He called it the Bhagavad Gita of hacker, maker, burner, open source, Git, GNU, Wiki, 99% adjunct faculty, anonymous, shareware, Thingiverse, cypherpunk, LGBTQIA, squatter, upcycling culture, zipped down into a pretty damn tight techno thriller with a lot of sex in it.
It is fantastic.
It was a really good quote.
It's a very, very good one. It's magnificent. Yeah. I wonder, have you sent it around to people like William Gibson?
Yeah, I sent a copy to Bill and also to Neil Gaiman and to someone else. I'm not going to talk about it until I get my quote from him because there's someone who's agreed to read it who I'm very, very excited about, one of my great heroes. So I'm hoping that he likes it enough to give me a quote, but I don't want to jinx it.
Yeah, you leave that mysterious. Tell me, what are you most excitedly reading now?
Well, I just finished a book that I was really excited about called, called Aurora by Kim Stanley Robinson. And I'm a huge Stan Robinson fan, but this was his best. Out of a field of amazing books, this was an even more amazing book. It's a big, audacious space opera that challenges the very idea of space operas and asks what it means to treat Earth as the cradle of humanity, as opposed to something that humanity is tethered to for all of our future, and how it encourages us to view ourselves as separate from the Earth in a way that science is increasingly showing us isn't true, that we are effectively colony organisms, that we coexist with these bacteria that are vital to our lives, and these bacteria are part of these larger, longer cycles that are connected to the whole planet, and that even on a spaceship that is, you know, has dozens of habitats, each of which are several kilometers long, that recreate parts of the Earth, that would still only be a trillionth the size of the Earth. And the homeostatic mechanisms that keep those alive and thriving would be severely disrupted by the scale. And so he pitches a very plausible story about the Earth being the only place that humans can ever live. It's an amazing novel. It's a very brave novel. He's faced a lot of stick for it from other writers, and he's really done his homework on technology. The other thing about this novel is that although it sounds like a kind of hippie Earth hugger novel, it is written in the style of a grand Heinleinian engineer-centric piece of fiction, where the core task of the characters in this book is solving engineering problems over and over again. The thing that they need to do to get out of trouble is ingeniously solve engineering problems. And what he shows by dint of causing them to address themselves to real engineering problems that have to do with extremely complex systems like ecosystems, as opposed to the relatively simple engineering problems of space travel, is he shows that what we thought of as the meaty, kind of hairy-chested technical problems of the world are actually the trivial ones, the relatively mechanical ones, and that the ones that where you get cascading problems that are nearly impossible to address and very difficult to predict, those are the biological and earth sciences that are really tricky. So that was an amazing book. And then the other book that I'm reading right now that I'm taking very slowly is Terry Pratchett's last book, The Shepherd's Crown. I couldn't finish chapter 2 in one sitting. It's you know, Terry Pratchett wrote this knowing that he was dying. He died very young of early onset Alzheimer's. And he wrote it knowing he was dying. And in it, it's not a spoiler really because it's in all the reviews, in it a character of his who has been in the books for nearly as long as he's been writing them prepares herself to die. And I just kept breaking down in tears. And, you know, it wasn't so much the author's own worries shining through as much as the insight that he'd gained into mortality by having to confront his in such a meaningful way so early and so publicly. And I'm savoring this book, but I also am finding it emotionally very traumatic to read. I interviewed him not long before he died, and he told me that these books, the Tiffany Aching books, of which this is, I think, the third, were the things he's most proud of. And at the time, I was a little surprised by it, because although I like them, I like these other books that he's written, the Moist von Ludwig books that are more about technology. I like those even better. But reading this last one, the last thing he ever wrote, knowing it would be the last thing he'd write, you can really see why these were his books. These were the books that mattered to him more than anything else. It's an amazing book.
Well, Corey, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. What are you going to do after our phone call now?
What am I doing today? Let me look at my schedule. So I've got a roundup. I do a weekly roundup for my colleagues at EFF of the work that I'm doing. So I've got to do that.
That's Electronic Frontier Foundation.
That's right. And I have an email outstanding from one of my colleagues that's a response to something that I've been waiting for a long time. He's been very busy. He's been at an internet governance forum and has discovered that someone that we've advocated on behalf may be sentenced to death. So he was very busy and didn't have a chance to review this work. So he's come back with some reviews and I have to respond to it and figure out if I'm going to post that publicly. And then there's a event I'm doing in D.C. next week that I've just gotten an email from while I was talking to you where they're looking for panelist feedback before I go and do that. And then I have to schedule a chat with someone from the White House, the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And then I'm going to go to lunch and have a swim.
Sounds like a good plan. It sounds like a busy day. Is this in some way what your days are made of usually?
Yeah, I have sort of three or four major sets of tasks that I do, and they're all interrelated, the science fiction, the stuff I do for Boing Boing, and the activism I do with Electronic Frontier Foundation, but what they do is they somewhat atomize my day. So there's a lot of different projects I do that each of them moves pretty incrementally each day, and the trick is to just have a list. I use a list every day of balls that I have in the air or of things that I'm trying to nudge up the hill. And I just make sure that each one gets a little pat every day. And in that way, everything moves forward and doesn't stall out. I'm a great believer in the getting things done method Paul something. Who wrote Getting Things Done? I know his book better than I know his name. Getting Things Done. I wanted to say Paul Allen, but that's not right. David Allen.
David.
Specifically the idea that if there's a thing that you intend to do that you fail to do, that you fail to do it because you looked at all the things that you wanted to do and decided that that one wasn't going to be a priority, and not because you incidentally, by not paying attention to how your time was being managed, happened to let something just fall off track.
I feel like I really need to read that book.
It's a really good book.
Well, among the many things you did today, I'm really happy that you and I spoke, and I'm happy to know that you're in this country, and that sometime I'll be able to hopefully bring you here to the New York Public Library in the near future.
I'm really looking forward to it. I hope that I'll come out, Walkaway comes out in 2017. That would make a lot of sense.
Have you read Ben Lerner?
Remind me. That rings a bell.
He
L-E-R-N-E-R, right?
L-E-R-N-E-R. He's someone who,
yeah.
I think he
wrote. Oh, he won the MacArthur.
This year, and he wrote two books that I think are absolutely magnificent, and I had him on this program a while back. One is called 1004, and the earlier novel is called Leaving the Atocha Station, and I think you and he would have a lot in common.
Yeah, I'm looking at his Wikipedia entry right now. It looks very good.
You really are able to do all of these things at the same time.
Ha! Well, I can certainly type with one hand.
Listen, thank you so much for speaking to us, and I hope to see you soon again.
Okay, and I just realized type with one hand sounded dirtier than I intended.
All the best, huh?
All right.
Take care.
Talk to you later.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Bye.